This is Troy and Joel, and you are listening to Revive Thoughts.
When these reflections press upon my mind, it is impossible for me to not feel both terrified and concerned at my own inadequacy to such a task.
Every episode, we bring you a different voice from history in a sermon that they delivered. Today, we got another William Wilberforce sermon coming to us from the year 1787. Troy Frazier, how are you doing over there? My man, it has been a hot second. It doesn't feel that long. I feel like I've been around you because I keep seeing your face on our social media. You've been blowing up our... You've been blowing up our social media with some grade A interesting content over there.
I really appreciate that, Joel. So I started during the summer. It was a quote unquote a break for the podcast, but it was really more of a time for me to launch and start projects that I've wanted to do for a very long time. For example, if you were to pull up your phone right now, which you should, and you put revivethoughts.com, you would see a brand new website. Our old website, though it looked pretty good, this one is so much better. In fact, you will find this episode already has its own page, so you could just immediately give it to a friend if you wanted to. And this website also has some new features that are really great. My favorite, the one I think is probably the most important, is a feature called Map. If you click the website and you go over to a map, you will see a Google map with a bunch of little crosses and stuff on it of the world. And every single one of those crosses is a location of an episode that we have done. And so it's a really good way to bounce around. If you're going, hey, I wonder if there's any church history in China, you can click the map and go, oh, look, they've done, you know, 5 episodes in China. Or, oh, they have an episode in New Zealand. I didn't know that Revive Studios had ever done that. And it's just been really useful. So a bunch of stuff like that. There are some blog articles there now. And Joel is right. I have also started making YouTube shorts that you can find on all of our social media and also on YouTube shorts. And they have been doing pretty well. People have been enjoying them. I've been getting both personal feedback from people saying they appreciated them and people I haven't talked to in years, I mean, a long time, suddenly reaching out and going, hey, thank you for those videos. But also people we know that are listeners of the show as well, saying, hey, we think this is a great thing to keep doing. So we've been really busy. And as we mentioned before the break, working on a book as well. It is nearly ready. So it's been going very, very well. I will say, I just want to make one quick correction right at the top. Joel said another William Wilberforce, but I must say, this is actually our first ever William Wilberforce.
Oh, that's right. He's been featured by name, I guess. But we haven't had an actual speech by him, I guess.
We've talked about him and his friendship with John Newton, and that's why it felt like he was here before. But that, I just wanted to make sure so nobody goes and pulls up their feet and goes, wait, where's the other
one? Where's the other Wilberforce?
The first one. And that's why I wanted this to be our first episode back, too, because I think it's a great speech, and I just think William Wilberforce is a pretty cool guy as well. But before we jump all into that, Joel, did you have a nice time, too, a nice break? I know you were traveling.
I did. Yep. Traveled one trip, and I'm in a downtime now until I travel for another trip upcoming. So it's a time to get editing done and get things charged back up and make some podcasting with you, which is exciting. Troy, for those who may be following you guys on social media, we see that your wife, your poor wife, broke her foot in a very vigorous game of badminton, was it?
I'd love to say it was vigorous, but it was very gentle, and it was just an offshoot. And my poor wife just slipped on a little ledge there playing with the kids and broke her foot, and it's been a bummer. I could tell you a myriad of ways it's not good to have a broken foot in Indonesia, from the fact that all the floors everywhere are tile, and that makes things very slippery with crutches, and the fact that every single place, including our house, has random stairs, like just like one or two stairs to nothing, that you have to maneuver, which is not easy. Traveling, we had to end up traveling to Singapore for medical care to get Elisa's foot better. It is better. It's going to be okay. And she's recovering slowly but surely. But it was just a very stressful last week of the summer for us to be doing all of that. We're really grateful that she's doing better and really grateful for many of you who saw these things on our social media and reached out to us. You prayed for us. Some of you donated to us, and it was extremely helpful and necessary beyond what we can even describe. At the same time, though, really looking forward to Elise getting on her feet again. She is not the kind of person that wants to sit in bed all day. Like, if we have a day off, she wants to go do something fun and hit the town and go somewhere new and adventure. And being forced to be basically bedridden because Indonesia is just not wheelchair accessible. There's no wheelchairs, period, anyway. And it's not been her favorite season. So keep praying for Elise to stay strong for a couple more weeks while she has to stay off of it, and then for the full recovery of her foot, because she likes to run too. She likes to exercise. And so we want her foot to be 100% and back at him. But yeah, that was not what we planned, but the Lord had his own plans. And we have seen some good things come from it, even though it was not necessarily what we were certainly hoping to wrap up the summer with.
Maybe a side effect would be she'll have a lot more time to record Martyrs and Missionaries now, huh?
If you're a Martyrs and Missionaries,
I'm sure that's probably the last thing on her mind.
Well, actually, no. She finished one episode on Russia. Man, that came out like a couple weeks ago. I'd never heard of the guy that she did. But if you are a listener, you learned about a really cool guy. And she's already got her next person that she's been reading the biographies of. Partially because, like you said, she was like, well, I don't have a lot to do right now. So let me get on Martyrs and Missionaries and get it a few episodes updated before she has to go back to doing some classwork to finish up some degree stuff. So she's working hard on that. Now, I was going to transition. Usually, this is kind of the part of the show where we transition to positive things. But I got to be honest, I have not been saving screenshots of your guys' interactions and comments. I will from this point on. Normally, I do throughout the summer, throughout each week, I try to put a few comments from everybody because we just appreciate you listening and sharing so much. But I just, over the summer, I was really trying to focus on those projects we were completing, and I did not. But I will say, I did have a few specific things that people sent us over the summer that really stood out to me. And we have a new Patreon supporter named Eric who really encouraged us and will hopefully be reading a sermon for us soon. But there was one person who sent in an email and asked if he could read our old sermons out in public. Like, he's going to do street preaching, and he asked his pastor what would be a good way to do it. And they said old sermons would be a cool way to do it. And so we sent him some of our old sermons. I'm really excited to hear back on that. I just thought that was really cool. I don't know. It just seems like, man, what will the Lord do? It'll be really neat to hear back from him. And I'm excited and interested to see. So there's just been a lot of stuff like that where people have just been appreciated. So we had a bunch of new people reach out to be speakers during this summer. I'm just really grateful for all that stuff. So thank you all of you who are listening to our show. And we are also grateful to be able to bring new things for you, like the videos and like a better website, so that hopefully we can get all of this good church history out to more people.
Okay. All right. Troy, do you want to talk about Wilberforce? William Wilberforce.
Yeah, I will say, let's get on with William Wilberforce.
Wilberforce is one of the guys that, like, kind of makes me proud to be a Christian in some ways. You know, like, when you look at, he's one of the examples you can pluck out when people say, like, why is Christianity good for humanity?
Yeah.
You know, like, there are those key figures. And a lot of people involved with the abolition movement, pretty much all of them, were religiously motivated by their convictions. And if we didn't have those people, who knows what the world would look like today. But Wilberforce, of course, a key player in championing and helping pass anti-slavery acts during his political tenure. It is kind of neat to see how he has contributed towards Christian morals overall on a humanitarian level, you know.
I agree. I feel like he's one of those people too that non-Christians and Christians kind of know his story and know his name. You know, when you have the angry anti-God person saying something like, oh, religion has never done anything good for the world, and you can go, well, actually, you know, if you know the story of William Wilberforce, that's why it's interesting to me. A lot of times today, history books, I say this as somebody who has to teach history, will try to kind of erase this side of it, that abolition was just this thing that sprang out of nowhere. And if you take away the Christians from the abolitionist movement, you don't have an abolitionist movement anymore. It is fundamentally a group of people who love Jesus, who looked around and saw something bad happening. And William Wilberforce and his mentor, John Newton, are the tip of that spear.
Yeah. And you mentioned John Newton now a few times in this episode. He will come back around in the story because he is a key part of Wilberforce's life, and also someone that we've done a sermon with it in previous episodes. But William Wilberforce, born in the year 1759 from a somewhat wealthy family. His grandfather was the mayor of the city he lives in, so he's kind of inherited a little bit of a prestigious name, claim to his name there. His family were wealthy merchants. But Wilberforce himself was a challenged child. The quote we have describing him as a child is that he was a small, sickly, and delicate child with poor eyesight. Which, that poor eyesight part I can relate with, because I, ever since I was a child, I had very poor eyesight as well. Wasn't too sickly, but couldn't see anything. So that, man, that resonates with me.
It's just one of those lines that you really, I don't know that I'd want that in history books about me. You know, like when people right. first look me up and like, what kind of kid was he? A poor, sickly, you know, like a small, sickly, and delicate child with poor eyesight. Oh, ouch, thanks.
Yeah, yeah, not a glowing review from the people around him, I suppose. When he was 10 years old, he was sent off to a Christian school. You know, some people often comment, you know, so this is the late 1700s. People say, well, weren't all schools Christian back then? And kind of, sort of. They, you know, they had their own flavors of Christian, much like we have today as well. But there were quite a bit of controversies within the school. This is the same era. We did an episode on John McGowan, who was actually thrown out of a Christian school around this time because of his beliefs. And so this is England, and so this is, you, there's a lot of, the Church of England is running most of the schools. There are other, they wouldn't be called Puritan schools. What would be?
At this point, the phrase I saw that was, he referred to as evangelical.
Evangelicals, wow. Not a new word. You know, it's been around a hot second, that evangelical word. Schools, that's what he would have been a part of, an evangelical school back in this era, not a Church of England type school that he probably would have gotten kicked out of. And it was at this school that he met a teacher called Joseph Milner. And Joseph became quite a mentor in his life, a lifelong friend. He would end up writing some church history books himself and kind of give Wilberforce a lot of guidance and encouragement on his journey there. But the person that certainly had the most impact on his life was the pastor of his church that his family went to growing up. And, you know, at this era and this time, it was a small church, you know, a little local church pastored by a John Newton. And John Newton would rise to quite prominence throughout his lifetime. And but here at the beginning, yeah, you know, at the beginning chapters of these people's lives, John Newton is a small town pastor that Wilberforce's family, they attended his church there, and Wilberforce is having these things introduced by his mentor, his teacher, these concepts of theology, and as we'll see, politics become an interest of his.
Yeah, I really love that emphasis, Joel, on just remember, they're not famous yet. It's so easy to read these stories and see them cross over with other famous or important people in church history and think to yourself, they've always been famous and important people, but when John and Charles Wesley met George Whitefield, they were just friends. When, you know, Martin Luther met some of the people he would work with later on, they didn't know they were going to be who they were someday to church history. And when John Newton was preaching and had this wealthy family come in on the summer holidays, and one of them had a young, you know, man in his teenage years named William, he didn't know that he was teaching the future man he would team up with to help do great things for the world. For him, it was, I'm preaching this sermon, and these are some of my people, and these are this family that comes in and travels in on the summers, and I'm going to share the gospel with them. Now, like you said, John Newton becomes famous. One of the reasons we know his name today, probably the reason you know his name today, is for the hymn Amazing Grace, which he wrote and had a different name for it at the time. We actually have the sermon that preceded that. Like, he wrote a sermon attached to that song, and we did it very early on in our history. But John Newton is famous for that. We've covered him several times on the show, so I think you should go check him out. And to be honest, we should probably cover him again. He's a great guy. But at the time, Wilberforce was just a kid coming in on the summers, and he was reaching out to his family and trying to mentor them the best he could. But I mean, who knows how often the pastor even talked to him. I'm sure he talked to him a bit, but who knows how much he even was interacting directly with them oftentimes, right? You talk to their parents, maybe. But he always remembered Newton's preaching and the powerful testimony Newton had of being a former slave trader himself and how Christ had turned him around. But at this moment, neither of them are famous. Newton's amazing grace is not well known or anything to the world, and Wilberforce is still young. It seemed for a while Wilberforce was really interested in God, but his family was worried he would become a Methodist, so they pulled him out of that good Christian school and sent him to an Anglican school that was run by more of a government school, and it was very dead. There was nothing happening there of any kind of godly interest. His religious interest and fervor completely diminished until it was pretty much gone, and he ended up slowly getting into the same worldly things that all his friends were. You know how it is. Same things that we have trouble with kids today. How do we educate them in a place that will grow their faith? Is the same stuff going on back then. Wilberforce was, I think, very interesting. He's kind of unique. So I feel like so many of the people we follow on this show, it's like he then studied every language known to man and won all these awards. And his first essay was considered, a world bestseller. Not at all. Wilberforce was very popular. He liked everyone and he hated studying. But despite hating studying, he managed to pass extremely challenging exams and get all his degrees at the same time that usually required people intense amounts of studying. But he didn't really care. He was more interested in having a fun party life. He was a famous party guy. He loved to sing. He loved to be that star center of attention. He was a very good speaker. One person who saw him speaking during this era said, quote, "I saw what seemed a mere shrimp get up on the table, but as I listened, that shrimp grew and grew until he had become a whale." I don't think he means that he was fat. I think he was saying that's the impact he had on him. What looked like just a normal little nobody, he could speak. This eventually led him into a career in politics. Again, so many of the people we cover on the show, it's, right to that first church, not William Wilberforce. He will not go directly into ministry like so many of the other people we have, but he does go into politics, another place where you need to be able to speak. And even though he was young, he got into and became a member of parliament. But despite all this fun, he said his life kind of felt empty, which I think is a little crazy because he was living in his 20s, a young man, and would be living what I think you would call, quote, the life. He was meeting celebrities. He went on a 6-week trip to Paris. He met King Louis. He met some of the great generals like General Lafayette. He met Benjamin Franklin when he was super popular in Europe. And you may be thinking, okay, he met a bunch of old people. No, but these guys were celebrities in their day. They didn't have, Taylor Swift traveling. They had people like Benjamin Franklin and stuff like that. And he was meeting them and eating with them and hanging out with them. At one point, the French royal court invites them to their summer house to spend the summer. He's chumming it with the 1700s version of all the big names. And his friend that he went on this trip with, when they get back to England, he becomes England's next prime minister. So that gives you an idea of just how close he is in powerful people and positions. And it gives you an idea of just how close he is with famous and important people. But he said, but my life still feels empty.
Yeah, so when he returned from this, his convictions, led him to, I really need to start taking this seriously. I really need to get into the Word of God, see what God is doing here. And so he talks about getting up extra early to read his Bible and to pray. And to me, that's how I know someone takes it seriously, because I am not a morning person. Morning time, it has to be really important to me if I'm going to get up early to do something, because it is a struggle for real. That's what he does, though. He gets up extra early, reads his Bible, he prays, and the Lord starts changing him outwardly. He was the same popular, fun guy to be around, but inside he felt like he could no longer do this. He could no longer go to the gambling halls. He could no longer go to the dances. And he sought spiritual advice from his old pastor, John Newton, and talked about his convictions. And he talked about how he doesn't feel like maybe, politics is right for him. There's so much corruption and selfishness and issues that go into politics that it's probably not right for the believer to be in. Seemed to be his convictions to where I should get out of politics and do something that's more honoring with my life. And it's his pastor, John Newton, that encouraged him, I think God has a plan for this. I think God has a plan for you in politics. I think you should stay in politics, and I think God's going to use that. And so with that advice, it changed his mind, and he thought, okay, let's do this. So He started a path that would end up in him being a lifelong politician, but one that has Christian ethics. And as you can imagine, this did not make him very popular. Progressives didn't trust him because of his outward faith. They would call him radical. And many in England just didn't trust him flat out because he was in what he described as evangelical, not an Anglican, which was the state religion there at the time. So he is not the popular denomination of Christianity, and he is a very outspoken public Christian in the way that he conducts his politics. So I'm sure you can imagine, yeah, that not being the best middle ground for politics, but that was a non-negotiable for him. That's what he was going to die on. Despite all of this, you know, he still wanted to use his position to influence others for Christ. And he did this in many ways, but the biggest one that we know of today and what he's certainly most remembered for is taking his fight to a parliament, essentially, regarding slave trade.
Yeah. Now, by the way, I just want to throw one of the weird ones out there that if you want to hear one of the other strange, like, so he tried to really live out his faith before we jump into the slave trade. One of the laws that he pushed to help pass was that whenever the government executed like a really bad criminal, doctors could use that body to, like, you know, do like practice surgery and stuff on, because doctors needed those kind of bodies to be able to work on. But England wanted everyone to be buried properly in a Christian way, as they would say. And so they had no bodies to work on. And so these doctors had no practice with surgery before they were doing surgery on people back then. And one of the ways you learned how to do it was through dead bodies. And so William Wilberforce was like, hey, government, why don't we help our doctors and our people get better medical care by allowing these people who are dying to be the people? Anyway, that's such a random one, but it's such a weird, I don't know. To me, I was like, that is so weird. But it wasn't just the slave trade. Like, that's what he's famous for. But there were a bunch of little things like that he was trying to do. He was really trying to make the life of the people better and come up with solutions to problems that we don't even, like, can't even comprehend problems like that today. But the one that obviously made the biggest impact that we're still thankful for him for today was the slave trade. And you may be familiar with the story, but it's important to realize, I think, when we hear this story, maybe many times, or maybe this is the first time you've ever heard of it, it was a real David and Goliath story. The slave trade was lining the pockets of many of Britain's politicians. To oppose it was crazy. Britain was huge and powerful, and one of the reasons they thought that they had become so powerful, at least everyone believed, was the slave trade. And most people just had no idea what it meant to be a part of the slave trade or any of that. They just assumed it was something they did. Maybe it was kind of yucky, but you didn't talk about it. And don't bring that up in polite company, right? That's not the kind of thing you ever want to bring up. You know, don't bring that up at the party or the dinner. That's going to make everyone feel uncomfortable. So the average person really just didn't think about it and didn't know what it was. In many ways, Wilberforce and Newton, who will team up with him, pioneered how to change society for the better without force. They educated the public with pamphlets, and they gave speeches everywhere, and they constantly kept bringing up the same issue over and over again. Slavery is bad. Do you know what these slaves are going through? Do you know what we're doing to get these slaves? Do you know what it's like to transport these slaves? John Newton, who was a former slave trader, would give examples and explain what life was like on the boats, and the people were shocked and horrified that that was going on, and their government was allowing it, and that their British citizens were making money off of it. They didn't know truly what was going on. And as they kept pushing and pushing the education of this issue, slowly over time, but not all at once, they did begin to change public opinion. And slowly that began to put pressure on politicians to quit voting with what the slave traders wanted. If you realize how bad something is, you don't want your politician to vote for it, and you're gonna say, I don't want to vote for you if you're gonna vote for that kind of thing. And that slowly, over the course of decades, began to make a difference. And something else he did that is not nearly as well remembered today, nobody really talks about this, is he wrote a book called Practical Christianity. Now, he felt called by God to explain how his Christian beliefs should logically influence our lives. He believed he was surrounded by people who claimed Christianity, claimed Christ, and they would go to church, but then when they lived their day-to-day lives, none of that stuff actually applied to life. And this book was not seen as a good idea. Literally, the publishers didn't even want to publish it. And they had so many people told them, don't do this. This is a stupid idea. You're already in hot water for going against the slave traders. You're already pushing boundaries. Why would you write a book? You're a politician, and you want to write basically a theological book and one that will be very controversial and will put a lot of attention on the fact that you're not Anglican, but that you're evangelical. Why don't you let the pastors write books like this? You should stay in your lane. Everyone was basically like, whatever you write in there, if you don't end up getting skewered for its theology being bad, you're only going to be getting a bigger target by a politician writing a theologian kind of book will only cost you votes. But he published it anyway. He felt like God was saying, I got to make this book and tell people about how they should live out their Christianity. He thought it would help get people to do it and to live out their faith in practical ways. He believed the reason we can't change Britain's slave trade is partially because we're surrounded by a bunch of people who don't live out their faith. So we have to get the people to start living out their faith before they're going to care about the British slave trade. Despite all the pressure against it, the book immediately sold out and immediately became a bestseller. No one had heard Christianity being described at that time in the early 1800s and late 1700s the way he was describing it. And to the idea that you're not supposed to just think the right thoughts about Jesus and go to church, but you're supposed to let that apply to the rest of your life, the way he wrote it down, the way he was so straightforward, it shocked everybody. And it was a little bit convicting, too. If a politician, those guys are supposed to be dirty bad guys, right, who take bribes and all that kind of stuff. If they're writing, if he can write a book that convicts me this bad, I've really got to step up my game, right? It's a little embarrassing with the, if the politicians are writing better theological books than everyone else is. And it would be considered a bestseller, top bestseller book for the next 50 years after it was published.
Hey, Kristen, how's it tracking?
With Carvana Value Tracker?
What else?
Oh, it's tracking. In fact, Value Surge Alert, trucks up 2.5%. Vans down 1.7%.
Just as predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, we gonna...
I don't know. Could sell, could hold.
The power to always know our car's worth.
Exhilarating, isn't it?
Tracking.
Always know your car's worth with Carvana Value Tracker.
Wilberforce did a lot of great stuff. We always try to be balanced on this show here. And so, you know, we'll mention that he wasn't perfect like all people. He had issues and struggles in life. One interesting one that we saw in our sources here was that it seems pretty clear that Wilberforce was addicted to opioids from what we can see. You know, he was prescribed some... for some injury at some point, and as far as we can tell, it seemed to be something that he couldn't shake, and very well may have had it the rest of his life, died the rest of it. We don't see any evidence that he ever stopped sourcing opioid sources throughout the rest of his life, which is, you know, I think it's interesting to see that here we are over 250 years ago, and prescription drug addiction is still, it was still just as much of a thing back then as it is today. And, you know, maybe that can be an encouragement to somebody out there knowing that they're not alone and that other people have gone through this as well. But despite that, he still had an incredible impact on the world that still felt to this day. Him and John Newton, you know, again, even from a secular standpoint, can very clearly, evidently, objectively be identified with ending the slave trade. And they gave that example, that model to the world for all of us to see. This speech that we're going to listen to here was one of his very early on ones in his political career where he was calling to end slavery. But this would have been at a time where support for abolition was unheard of. He was championing this idea. And slowly, the idea would take root and it would grow and it would form into the abolition movement. But at this time, imagine the amount of courage it would take to get up before the House of Commons and preach this speech to this political body when you knew that everyone was against you.
Mm-hmm.
When I consider the magnitude of the subject which I am to bring before the House, a subject in which the interests, not of this country, nor of Europe alone, but of the whole world and of posterity are involved, and when I think, at the same time, on the weakness of the advocate who has undertaken this great cause, when these reflections press upon my mind, it is impossible for me to not feel both terrified and concerned at my own inadequacy to such a task. But when I reflect, however, on the encouragement which I have had, through the whole course of a long and laborious examination of this question, and how much candor I have experienced, and how conviction has increased within my own mind, in proportion as I have advanced in my labors, when I reflect, especially, that however averse any gentleman may now be, yet we will all be of one opinion in the end, when I turn myself to these thoughts, I take courage. I determine to forget all my other fears, and I march forward with a firmer step in the full assurance that my cause will bear me out, and I shall be able to justify upon the clearest principles every resolution in my hand, the avowed end of which is the total abolition of the slave trade. I wish exceedingly, in the outset, to guard both myself and the House from entering into the subject with any sort of passion. It's not their passions I shall appeal to. I ask only for their cool and impartial reason, and I wish not to take them by surprise, but to deliberate, point by point, upon every part of this question. I mean not to accuse anyone, but to take the shame upon myself, in common, indeed, with the whole Parliament of Great Britain, for having suffered this horrid trade to be carried on under their authority. We are all guilty. We ought all to plead guilty, and not to excuse ourselves by throwing the blame on others, and I therefore deprecate every kind of reflection against the various descriptions of people who are more immediately involved in this wretched business. Having now disposed of the first part of this subject, I must speak of the transit of the slaves in the West Indies. This, I confess, is my own opinion, is the most wretched part of the whole subject. So much misery condensed in so little room is more than the human imagination had ever before conceived. I will not accuse the Liverpool merchants. I will allow them, no, I will believe them to be men of humanity, and I will therefore believe, if it were not for the enormous magnitude and extent of the evil which distracts their attention from individual cases and makes them think generally and therefore less feelingly on the subject, they would never have persisted in the trade. I truly believe, therefore, if the wretchedness of any one of the many hundred Africans stowed in each ship could be brought before their view and remain within the sight of the African merchant, that there is not one among them whose heart would bear it. Let anyone imagine to himself 600 or 700 of these wretches chained, 2 and 2, surrounded with every object that is nauseous and disgusting, diseased and struggling under every kind of wretchedness. How can we bear to think of such a scene as this? One would think it had been determined to heap upon them all the types of bodily pain, for the purpose of blunting the feelings of the mind, and yet, in this very point, to show the power of human prejudice, the situation of the slaves has been described by Mr. Norris, one of the Liverpool delegates, in a manner which, I am sure, will convince the House how money can draw a film across the eyes, so thick that total blindness could not do more. And how it is our duty, therefore, to trust not to the reasonings of profiting men, or their way of painting over a transaction. Their apartments, says Mr. Norris, are fit for their advantage, as circumstances will admit. The right ankle of one, indeed, is connected with the left ankle of another by a small iron fetter, and if they are rebellious, by another on their wrists. They have several meals a day, some of their own country provisions, with the best sauces of African cookery, and by way of variety, another meal of according to European taste. After breakfast, they have water to wash themselves, while their apartments are perfumed with frankincense and lime juice. Before dinner, they are amused after the manner of their country. The song and dance are promoted. As if the whole ordeal was really a scene of pleasure and fun, it is added that games of chance are often played. The men play and sing, while the women and girls make fanciful ornaments with beads, which they are plentifully supplied with. Such is the sort of argument in which the Liverpool delegates, and particularly Mr. Norris, gave evidence before the council. What will the House think when, by the agreeing testimony of other witnesses, the true history is laid open? The slaves, who are sometimes described as rejoicing at their captivity, are so shaken with misery at leaving their country that it is the constant practice to set sail at night so that they should not actually be aware of their departure. The European food which Mr. Norris talks of are horse beans, and the scantiness both of water and provision was suggested by the very legislature of Jamaica in the report of their committee to be a subject that called for the interference of Parliament. Mr. Norris talks of frankincense and lime juice. When surgeons tell you the slaves are stowed so close together that there is not room to tread among them, and when you have it in evidence from Sir George Young that even in a ship which was carrying 200 less than what was usual, the stench was intolerable. The song and the dance, says Mr. Norris, are promoted. It would have been more fair, perhaps, if he had explained that word promoted. The truth is that for the sake of exercise, these miserable wretches, loaded with chains, oppressed with disease and wretchedness, are forced to dance by the terror of the lash, and sometimes by the actual use of it. I, says one of the other witnesses, was employed to dance the men, while another person danced the women. Such, then, is the meaning of the word promoted. And it may be observed, too, with respect to food, that an instrument is sometimes carried out in order to force them to eat, which is the same sort of proof of how much they enjoy themselves in that instance also. As to their singing, what will we say when we are told that their songs are songs of lamentation upon their departure, which, while they sing, are always in tears, insomuch that one captain, more humane as I should conceive him, therefore, than the rest, threatened one of the women with a flogging because the mournfulness of her song was too painful for his feelings. In order, however, not to trust too much to any sort of description, I will call the attention of the House to one species of evidence which is absolutely infallible. Death, at least, is a sure ground of evidence, and the proportion of deaths will not only confirm, but if possible, will even aggravate our suspicion of their misery in the transit. It will be found, upon an average of all the ships of which evidence has been given to the council, that exclusive of those who perish before the sale, not less than 12.5% perish in the passage. Besides these, the Jamaica report tells you that not less than 4.5% die on shore before the day of sale, which is only a week or two from the time of landing. 1/3 more die in the transition, and this in a country exactly like their own, where they are healthy and happy, as some of them attempt to say. The diseases, however, which they contract on shipboard, the astringent washes which are to hide their wounds, and the mischievous tricks used to make them up for sale, are, as the Jamaica report says, a most precious and valuable report, which I shall often have to advert to, one principal cause of this mortality. Throughout the whole process, however, there is a mortality of about 50%. How, then, can the House refuse its belief to the multiplied testimonies before the council of the savage treatment of the Africans in the Middle Passage? No, indeed, what need is there of any evidence? The number of deaths speaks for itself, and makes all such additional investigation superfluous. As soon as I had arrived so far in my investigation of the slave trade, I confess to you, sir, so enormous, so dreadful, so evil did its wickedness appear that my own mind was completely made up for the abolition. A trade founded in such sin and filth, and carried on as this was, must be abolished. Let the policy be what it might. Let the consequences be what they would. I, from this time, determined that I would never rest till I had effected its abolition.
If you look at this speech, it's not a very long one. It's a pretty short episode to jump back into. And yet, I think there is so much to apply today. Obviously, I don't think that this episode is about let's end the slave trade in Britain today, because we know that that should be over. But what it does, I think, is gives us a model to look at how to deal with things. One of the biggest questions we as Christians often have to ask, especially this is a, if you're an American, this is a political election year. And even if you're not an American, you usually end up hearing about American politics, right? We Christians, we want to have a good influence on the world, and we want to have a good influence on the things that are happening around us. And I'm not, you may, oh, you know, are you thinking a particular issue right now? I am not. What I am thinking of right now, though, is just look at what William Wilberforce and John Newton did. They saw a problem. They began speaking and teaching and making this a well-known thing, and they took a lot of heat for that position, but they did it over and over again, telling people to act like Christians, encouraging them, writing books, whatever it took. They did it because they loved Jesus and they wanted to see something better happen. And it seemed impossible on the outset. When this speech was given, I'm sure he had blowback. I'm sure people attacked him. I'm sure they ran counter speeches. It was probably a nightmare. And he had to wonder, is this ever going to happen? I will it be in my lifetime or a long time from now? Yet, over time, everything changed. And I think just as Christians, we need to think, kind of remind ourselves, that's the way we need to be working as well. The whole world may be against us. Whatever it is, though, that we're calling to, when we are called to remember the poor and we are called to remember the oppressed, and we're called to do all these different things that the Lord has called us to do. Let's be reminded, you know, what is the slave trade of today that maybe the whole world is currently overlooking? You know, nobody really knew how bad what John Newton and Wilberforce was and what they were talking about until they started to really highlight it. The average citizen didn't care. And I know that 100 years, 200 years from now, it'll be great Christians who called attention to something like this that we will go, wow, I'm so grateful for those Christians who saw that issue that was happening at that time and they worked to address it. And I just hope that we will be awake enough to see what's happening and going, oh yeah, when the Christians start moving and calling on that issue, we will all come together to do that. That is something, it maybe sounds a little too picturesque, but it probably sounded too picturesque to William Wilberforce giving that speech, and yet look at the result that it had.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Revived Thoughts. Today's sermon was narrated by Nick Garland, who's a worship pastor in Pennsylvania. Big thanks to Nick, and we're happy to be back, Troy. It feels good. It feels right.
Yeah. No, we're really glad to be back. And if you're listening right now, all I'm going to ask you to do is share this episode. Tell people Revived Thoughts is back and putting up sermons and speeches and getting back on the track here. So tell everyone, hey, they're doing it again. Please share our episodes with everybody. And I also want to say a special thank you. I forgot about this group of people when we were thanking people. Thank you to those of us who reached out and told me, well, I have been going through all of your episodes from beginning to end lately and really enjoying them. We have 5 years worth of episodes. That's hundreds of episodes. And yet there are quite a number of you who are working your way through the entire catalog. I personally have been deeply enriched to make these 5 years worth of episodes. But it is always really cool to hear people going back to the early ones and going, no, these sermons are really good at the beginning of 5 years and are all the way through. Like, there's so many good episodes. I just want to thank you. I can't remember all your names right now, but I know there were several of you who reached out to us over the break and was like, hey, I've just been enjoying all of it. So thank you so much for those of you who have been listening. Please share this episode and tell people about it. In the meantime, this is Troy and Joel. You've been listening to Revived Thoughts.